Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Okay. Well, good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. Just one moment, please. Someone was at my door, but now they're gone. It's okay. All right, this is scan number 2670. And tonight we're going to have a guest who's going to come on. In fact, she's here right now. And tell her story, okay, about what happened to her when she was a child. And finally we get into what she's doing today, okay? So her name is Janice Simmons, and she's from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and she's an American born in Japan. Okay, she was born in Japan in the mid-1950s and raised there with her siblings. Now, I'm not going to say too much more than that, because the first thing I'm going to do is read the mission statement, and then once we do that, and I talk a little bit about NASCA, and what we do here, then we'll certainly get to our guests. So just hold on. We have people that are calling in now. This is good. Okay. The NASCA mission, we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, and that's including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public. Very important. Especially as relating to getting the society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay. So this is very important. We're fighting a battle. Okay, that's what it is, a battle. We're a bunch of soldiers. That's what we are. And but as time goes by, we are talking more about child abuse. There's all different kinds of organizations now. And NASCA is right at the top, you bet, because I've been on this show for 11 years. I'm Carol Levine. I am vice president of NASCA. And over the years, we've had on magnificent people who tell us all different kinds of stories and also, too, give us a lot of education, things that we can hold on to, like organizations from Child Help, so, you know, things like that. And so tonight, our lady tonight, she's the CEO of Hope Ministries, and we will get into that much later on. But tonight, what I'm going to do, as the panel builds, I'm going to let her start out by telling her story. And again, her name is Janet Simmons, and she's from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And again, she's American, born in Japan. Go ahead, tell us about what happened with you. Go ahead, from your earliest remembrance. Go ahead.
Okay, good morning, or good evening. I guess good evening, good morning for everybody all around the world, if there's anybody else that's joining us. So thank you for the introduction, Carol. So what happens sometimes when I tell my story, I tend to revert back to my 11-year-old child. So just kind of expect that to happen. And I also get very, very shaky. My voice might start shaking. And so that happens a lot. I just wanted to make you aware of that before I go forward. So
that's
my
okay.
My parents went to Japan in 1951, right after the war, and they, my oldest brother was already born. He was born in in Louisiana, and then all the rest of us. I have two sisters and two brothers. The rest of us were born in Japan. And my parents were missionaries, Southern Baptist missionaries. They were there for 35 years. And so I was born in 1959, and we lived in the southernmost island called Kyushu, which is the southernmost island besides Okinawa. Okinawa is considered really not to be a part of Japan, although it is a part of the Japanese islands. Anyway, so in 1965, we moved to an area called Nagoya, Japan, which is in the central island of Honshu. And we lived there for 5 years. And then my sisters and older siblings were in a dorm at the school. And the dorm shut down because there was kids were drinking and smoking and everything. And all the parents were, like, upset about that. So they shut the dorm down, and so we ended up having to move up to Tokyo because that's
Hello? Yeah. I think we lost her.
We lost our guest. Okay. She'll be calling back in, I'm sure.
I certainly hope so. Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
I think. Okay. I think she will in a second.
Hello.
There she is.
Janet?
Yeah, we have her now. Mm-hmm. We have her. Okay. I don't know if you realize or not, but we lost you like for about 3 minutes, something like
Carol,
that.
Carol, it was less than a minute, but it was me. Inadvertently clicked the wrong button on Janet. So she's back with you, and we did miss about a minute, Janet. You had said you'd move to the central part of Japan after Okinawa.
Okay,
move back up north.
Okay, got it. So, all right. So after Nagoya, after Nagoya, we lived there for 5 years, and then my siblings, who were living in the dorm at American School in Japan dorm in Tokyo, and by the way, a lot of sexual abuse has happened overseas in the dorms where kids have been shipped off to dormitories while their parents are serving in kind of remote locations, and there's a huge amount of sexual abuse happening in the dormitories internationally, and one of the reasons is because international laws are so much more lax than the ones in the United States, and so a lot of predators go overseas to get their victims. So anyway, so my siblings were in the dorm, and they were causing problems with the dorm parents, smoking and drinking and all those kinds of things that teenagers tend to do. And so the parents got very upset, and so they closed the dorm, and the parents had to go and move up to American School in Japan so that the kids could finish their education, which angered my father. He was very frustrated because he couldn't do what he felt like his work that he was called to do. And so we ended up moving to Tokyo, and we lived right outside of Tokyo. There's an Air Force base called Chofu Air Force Base in Chofu, Tokyo, Japan. And so our school was right next to the Chofu Air Force Base, and so we had a lot of were military, Department of Defense friends, and then just regular friends from corporate America that their parents were stationed in Japan. Back in the 70s, there was a huge group of corporate America that was in Japan for things like Texas Instruments or Flying Tigers. Lots of different companies that were represented, IBM, et cetera. So our friends, we went to the American School in Japan. We had 28 different nationalities there. We had corporate DOD, Department of Defense people. We had embassy people. One of my dance partners was the son of the ambassador to Kuwait for our musicals that we were doing. And so, I mean, we had a lot of different diverse people that we went to school with.
And so we know people all over the world because of that. And so I can pretty much go anywhere in the world and know that I've got one of my ASIJ friends there that I can contact, which is kind of cool. Anyway, so in seventh grade, I was in seventh grade when we moved. And I'm young for my age in terms of when I started school. So I started kindergarten when I was four. And so I was always the youngest in my class, always the youngest. So I started seventh grade when I was 11. And one of the classes that I took was called the Japan Lands and People. And it was led by a teacher named Jack Moyer. And he was a very popular teacher. Everybody loved him. In fact, he had his groupies. He had his seventh grade girls that would go and sit in his office, and he would treat us unbelievably nice. I mean, he was kind. If you were a friend of Jack Moyer's, you were a cool kid. It was very, very, very enticing for a person who was young, wore glasses that were very, very thick because I'm almost blind as a bat. And I was brand new to the school, didn't know very many people. And I was a quick prey, very quick for him. He also lived right around the corner from my house, and he had two German Shepherd dogs that he would go walk every morning on the golf course. And so he invited me to come to the golf course and go walk the dogs, and that's how it all started. And so I was like, of course, I'm a cool kid. I'm in the in crowd. I want to make sure I'm, you know, welcomed and whatnot. So I went and walked the dogs with him. And this was like at 6 o'clock every morning. And then we would go back to his house and he would make me coffee and we would chat and whatever. And he started with a back massage and started
grooming.
Mm-hmm.
He was grooming me, right.
And so started with a back massage, and then it moved to more more abuse, more physical abuse. He also owned a house on Miyakejima, which is an island in the Japan Sea, that he would take seventh grader groups to every year. And so we would have our Japan Lands and People retreat, like a whole week trip to the island. And we would have chaperones with us, and we would go as our field trip for the year. And all the seventh graders got to go do this. And they would go to stay in his house. And his house was set up like this. It was a typical Japanese house that had what's called tatami floors. Those are the straw floors that you'll see sometimes in restaurants with the tatami mats on them. And you would roll your futon out onto the mats, and everybody would sleep side by side like if you had a mattress you'd throw on the floor. And everybody was just side by side, side by side, side by side. And there was a girl's room, and then there was a boy's room, and then there was a middle room where the chaperone slept. So that summer, after my Japan Lands and People trip to the Miyakejima Island, I was invited to come back to go as the So this particular teacher, Jack Moyer, was a marine biologist. He was a very famous marine biologist. He helped save some of the Japanese islands from being bombed during the war because of a bird that was there. And so he was very successful in keeping the U.S. from bombing those islands and keeping these birds safe. And so he was very famous. He published with Jane Goodall, international publisher. So, I mean, all of the things about him, the school kept him because he was, you know, he was a positive influence for people to, you know, want to send their children to that school.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
So he had this home, and when the summer of between my seventh and eighth grade year, he invited me to come to get his class. All summer he had like a summer marine biology camp. And he had kids coming in for a week at a time, and they would go to the camp, and they would learn about marine biology. Well, I was, you know, I was young. I was the youngest in my class, not very academic,
not particularly in biology or anything like that. And so that wasn't, you know, up my wheelhouse. But he invited me to come to the pre-camp week to get ready for the camp. So he always had a pre-week where everybody would come in and clean and get ready for the real campers to come. And so it was during that time that he asked me, when we were getting ready for bed, for me to put my futon in the middle room next to his, so that in the middle of the night he could visit me.
Right.
So I complied with his request because I was, again, 11. By this time I was 12. I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be, you know, cool, all those things. And that felt like, okay, I'm willing to sacrifice that for that reason. And my parents had no clue. I mean, this was back in the 70s. Nobody knew what was going on with kids and sexual abuse and whatnot. And so my parents allowed me to go, and there were no other chaperones. He was the only chaperone. So it's in my purse, in the side pocket of my purse. So he continued to abuse me at night during the time that I was there at the camp. And then I would go home. So we rode a ferry over there to get to the island. And we would ride a ferry back to Tokyo Bay, get off at the ferry. And there's a significance for this. The reason I'm telling you this, because it's another part of the story later on. There's a real significance for that.
Okay,
so
go ahead. You're doing a fine job, by the way. You're doing well.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I got on the ferry and went home, and then this continued to happen. So I went back multiple times with several of my friends. We went together. We would go to the black sand beaches that were gorgeous, just beautiful. Didn't realize while I was there that two of my other friends that were with me were also being sexually abused by him. They didn't know I was. I didn't know they were. And this continued to go on with me until I was in ninth grade. Finally, in ninth grade, I was at Miyake, and, well, there's a little backstory to this, too. And if you go to my blog, you can read the whole thing. I'm kind of skipping over some stuff. But there's one thing that I think is really critical to talk about is this. I had impetigo, which is a very, very contagious rash.
Oh, I know what that is, yeah.
And because I had impetigo, I never got raped by him. I do believe that God protected me from that. And I think there's a real significance in the story there because he would put ointment on my impetigo, and there was one time where some girls walked in on him. Of course, it was in my private parts, so he was putting ointment on there so that I could get, you know, heal, because he wanted me to heal, obviously, because he wanted something else, but I just didn't, it wouldn't go away. So some other girls witnessed him doing that, and they walked in and they abruptly turned back around. And I didn't remember this until later on when I was able to report this. One of the girls remembered that it happened, and she reported that. So anyway, so let's see. So when the abuse stopped, when in ninth grade, when one of my friends, Michelle Connor, Michelle Connor was sleeping in the girls' room. And she witnessed me being abused by him. And so she, one night, she came to me before we put our stones out, and she said, "Janet, come put your stone next to me." And immediately I was relieved. It was like a huge lift off of my shoulders. She was able to protect me, and I no longer was abused by him.
Right. Yeah.
I did not realize this. I did not realize this, but in 11th grade, I went back out to the island as a chaperone, as a counselor. And I did not remember that I had done that. One of my teachers, who was involved in the
in the whole process when we reported it to the school told me that he was out there with me, and I don't recall that at all. But there's a lot of stuff that I don't remember. A whole lot of stuff I don't remember.
Let's stop there. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go to the panel because we have a full panel here now. And I think they've heard, you know, enough where they can, maybe they have a question or they want to make a comment. I'm going to go to Pamela first from Louisiana, and she's also the ambassador of Louisiana. Pamela, why don't you ask her a question or make a comment if you have one?
Yes, Janet. So happy that we're able to make it today. Thank you for filling in quickly. You filled in quickly when we had a cancellation, and I'm so thankful for that. The other thing is, if there's any noise in the background, anybody that's got their mics open, please reduce the noise in the background so that it doesn't get into the recording for later. But anyway, it's just sad to hear that this man who was so, popular was able to do this and get away with it. You know, it reminds me of that gymnast guy that did this to so many girls. You know, the current, it wasn't too long ago, that gymnast. Do you see any correlation between that? Does that kind of, when you saw that with those gymnasts, did that trigger you or anything? Did that bring memories back?
When the gymnast teacher did that?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
With that? Yeah.
Not particularly that case. It was more the case up in what was the school? University of Pennsylvania or what? It was the coach, that was the one that really triggered me. And so did the one where the girl was abducted, Dugal or whatever her name is. And she was abducted and she was kept in solitude or whatever for, like, captured for 11 years, something like that. That really got me, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So were you able to report this at any time to your parents, or was it just, did he threaten you not to tell?
He never said anything. Yeah, he never said anything to me about not telling my parents. Never did any of that. He never had to. He just didn't have to because I knew what was going to happen with my parents. And so that wasn't going to be a threat at all. Because let me give you a little history about that. So my dad, this is what we grew up with as kids. My dad taught us from the time we were two or three that men could not help themselves. So therefore, it was the woman's responsibility to stop it. And so I carried this burden of the fact that men couldn't help themselves, and it was my responsibility to stop it. So I knew if I took it to my dad, he was going to tell me it was my fault.
Oh, my goodness.
So I knew that's what was going to happen, so I couldn't tell them. I didn't tell my parents until I was 36 years old. And when I did tell my parents, I had to have my siblings surround me because I knew what their reaction was going to be. And I had to get enough courage to tell them and be able to handle the way that they were going to respond to it.
We have a large panel. Let me go down. Thank you for that, though, Pamela. That I was thinking, too, and I'm sure a lot of people were, too, as well, as to why you didn't tell your parents, but now we understand why. And what a way to think, huh? Oh, my God.
Right.
Yes. Oy, oy, oy. All right, let me go down to Doug from Maryland. I'm going to open up his mic and see if he has a question that he'd like to ask or more make a comment. Go ahead, Doug.
I don't really have a question. I'll just say thank you for being brave and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Okay.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Doug. And she is very brave. It is a brave thing to come on, whether you're male or female, to tell your story. and it shows growth. And you're on your healing journey, and you've gotten yourself to the point where you have even, you know, you are a part of Hope. In fact, you are the CEO of Hope Ministries, and we're going to get into that much later on. So you see, I like to tell people this: there is life after abuse. Because that's what,
yep.
It's true. It just simply is. But you have to get to that point. And a lot of times it's a very hard thing to do. Now, you're doing fine. I just want you to know that. And so I'm going to go down to Janet from Louisiana. No, that's you. That's Bill's listening. Yeah. Here's Darlene. Darlene's not feeling too well tonight. Let's see if she wants to respond. Go ahead.
Hello. You are very brave on telling your stories. I want to say that, you know, it's similar to how we were treated, or how I was treated, how you were to respect, and whatever the adult says, you have to do, you know. So that puts me in the same kind of mindset and understanding that you went through on, you know, on a self-blame type of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You got a lot of courage telling your story.
Thank
I want to thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank you too, darling. Okay, let me close your mic and go down to, there's a 2256 area code. I'm going to open up your mic. There we go.
Hello.
Who am I speaking to?
This is William.
Oh, okay. How you doing, William? Okay.
All right. I had to get a new phone. That's why you didn't recognize the number.
No, not at all. I didn't know who I was speaking to. You know, this is awful what you're saying, because it's so true that a lot of times, remember way back when, oh, my God, we didn't question anything. We didn't question anything. You know, and God forbid if you did, you get slapped in the head or something. But she was told, look what she was told, and then this way, you know, it was up to the women to stop it. The women can't stop men from doing that, okay? It just doesn't work that way. There's other ways of doing it today. But back then, everything went under the carpet, didn't it? You know,
yep.
And women had to, that's right. Okay, well, let's get back to your story then, okay, and we'll go from there.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. So when I was a sophomore, we came back to the States for a year on furlough, and we lived in North Carolina at the time, Wake Forest, North Carolina, and I fell in love with my first boyfriend, which was wonderful. His name was Billy, and I still kind of stalk him a little bit on Facebook to see where he is. But he was the sweetest, kindest young man. And he actually came to Japan for prom. I think it was my junior or senior year, junior year. And anyway, when I got back to Japan, I still hadn't come to grasp with the abuse. I knew that it had stopped, but I still didn't understand what had happened to me, and I still cared deeply for this teacher. And so when I got back to Japan after I'd been gone for a year, I went out to meet the ferry coming off of the island when I knew he was going to be coming back in to go to ASIJ to start teaching again that summer, that fall. And I met the ferry. I'd just come back from the States, hadn't been there for a year. I went and met the ferry, and he got, well, there's a couple stories about the ferry I want to tell you. He got off of the ferry, and he saw me on the sidewalk, and he goes, oh, hi, Janet, and then walked past me. And it broke my heart. It just broke my heart. I was devastated. I was like, what, I thought there was something to our relationship. And that hurt me almost more than the abuse did. And then one more thing about the ferry that's kind of an interesting story. So there was one time we were on the island. There was a whole group of us on the island. And that fall or that spring or whatever, we were doing the musical Oklahoma.
And there's a song in Oklahoma called Why, Oh, Why, Oh, Why, Oh, Why, Oh, Why Did I Ever Leave Ohio? And so my friend and I changed the lyrics, and we said, why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why did we ever leave Miyake? And we were singing that song while we were on the ferry with Moyer. He was on the ferry with us. And we started crying because we were leaving the island, and he got very angry, very, very, very angry, because he loved the fact that we were crying when we were leaving him, but he didn't want us to be crying when we were leaving the island. And the island meant a lot to us. It was a special place to us. And so that was another side of him that we saw briefly when he got very, very angry about not being the person. He thought that our tears were because of him, and he liked that. But when it was for the island, he did not like that. And so that was kind of an interesting thing that he displayed. So anyway, my junior year, that happened to me with the ferry, and evidently I had gone during my junior and senior year, or between my junior and senior year, as a counselor to the island. I don't remember that. Again, my teacher told me that. So then I came back to the States and started going to college, and I went back to Japan for the next two summers. During that time, I suffered from anorexia, got very, very, very thin. Had a horrible relationship with an older man who was 11 years my senior. It was horrible. It was my freshman year of college. And I ended up leaving my freshman year of college and going down to Florida to stay with my sisters because I had to get away from him. And I started thinking about going to Baylor in Texas to go to school, and my mom came back home because my sister was having a hard time with the relationship that she had, and so my mom came, and she and I kind of tolled around a little bit for the summer, and we started talking, and I felt like I was safe to go back to Mississippi, so I went back to Mississippi College near Jackson, Mississippi, and got back into school there, and I had gained back all my weight that I had lost when I was anorexic. So I started back with my sophomore year, and I changed my major. So I was a music major at first, and then I went into business and marketing as my major after I got back, because I love to play the piano, but I don't like to have to practice 8 hours a day. It just didn't, it didn't go for me. So I ended up changing my major to business and finance, and I excelled at it. So all my grades, my first 2 years of college were horrible. My grades, my last 2 years of college were great. So I ended up graduating, and I met my husband at Mississippi College, and we got married. I actually got pregnant, and we got married, lived in Dallas at the time, and had our son, moved to Austin, and then we moved to Tennessee. He got a job in Tennessee that moved us to Columbia, Tennessee. And his job, he was a Rotarian. And that was when the Rotary Club was still all men. And so every year they would have wives, bring your wives to Rotary Club. And so this one particular Rotary Club day, he said, well, why don't you come to lunch with me? And I said, sure, I'll be glad to. And he said, so we went to lunch, and they had a woman there who was speaking at the Rotary Club who was speaking about child sexual abuse. And I was listening to her, and one of the statistics that she said was that one out of four girls and one out of six boys are sexually abused. Now, I actually think that statistic's much higher than that. And I started looking around the room, and I said, well, that means there's 12 people at my table. That means one out of this many people. And it just kind of dawned on me, oh, my God, it's me. I'm the one. I'm the statistic. And it completely, like,
it was a punch in the gut. You know, it was one of those times where I was going, oh, I can't believe I've put this out of my mind. I haven't thought about it. My brother told me later on that I did tell him about it when I was a freshman. But I didn't remember telling him about it because it was during the Jim Jones trial. Remember in Grenada when Jim Jones took the life?
Yeah.
It was that weekend that I went to his house. He lived in Cleveland, and I was visiting him and my sister-in-law, and the Jim Jones debacle or massacre came. And so, I mean, there's so much going on that weekend that I don't remember, you know, what all I told him. But evidently I had told him about the abuse. I didn't know that I had told him about it. So then after that meet, that Rotary meeting I had, it was just like, okay, I'm the statistic. So what do I do with this? But I didn't do anything with it at the time. I really just kind of put it in the back of my mind and just left it. Because at that point, I still thought I was the only one. I really thought I was the only one that had been sexually abused. So
right.
I had already had two children at that point. We moved to Nashville in 1993, I think. I can't remember. We lived there for 5 years. Yeah, I think that's right, 1992, we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, with my husband's work. And then in 1997, we moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And the day that we moved into Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I got an email about my childhood home up in Nojiriko, Japan, which was our summer family home, burned to the ground, and a little girl died with her dog in the fire. And I was very upset. I was very, very upset about that. And then 3 years later, I get this email that comes across in the year 2000. I get this email that crosses my email from a girl who is a student at ASIJ asking for students to donate to the Jack Moyer Fund to save his home in Miyake-jima because it was a volcanic island and the volcano erupted and he lost his home.
Right.
And she wanted people to donate to him to help him because he didn't have any money. And I went, oh, wow, okay. But backtrack. I'm sorry, I'm going to digress for a second. So in 1990, we had a reunion in Long Beach, California, and it was the 70s reunion, so the ASIJ 70s reunion in Long Beach, California. And one of the things that the 70s reunion committee did was vote for your favorite teacher. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew that the vote was going to be for him. And so I contacted the committee, and I said, let me just tell you what happened to me. And I don't want to cause any problems. I don't want to be, you know, do anything. I just want to let you know what happened to me so that you can take into your thought process when you announce who the favorite teacher is. Because if you announce that Jack Moyer is the favorite teacher, then I'm going to blow it wide open. I'm going to tell my story. And so they, of course, he was nominated as the favorite teacher, and they did stop it. And at the time, the headmaster of the school, Downs, this is his last name, was privy to all of the knowledge. Now, he was the headmaster of the school, 1990. Mm-hmm. So the committee took Jack Moyer's name off, and another one of the second, and the second teacher who was nominated got the award, and then nothing happened to it. So then we went from 1990 to 2000 when the volcano hit. Volcano hit, and I get this email from this woman who was one of his former students who she and her family loved Jack Moyer and they supported him. They loved him so much. And evidently he stopped teaching at ASIJ in 1985 and he married a Singapore girl, Filipino, when he was in his 70s and she was 18.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Oh, well. That's a bit much, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but if you're familiar with any kind of international sexual abuse, Philippines is a horrible sexually abused. I mean, it's a country that has so much sexual abuse. So,
well, we do know that it's rampant all throughout the whole world, okay? And we also know too that in say like in the third world countries, places like that, there's just so much abuse that goes on with little girls, and they're made to marry many times older men, and that's just plain, you know, that's horrific. And then also, too, they get mutilated. There's just so many things with abuse and sexual abuse. Yes.
Right.
And we do talk about that. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you something for a second here. We're having a terrible storm, so if I all of a sudden disappear, you know why. All right, but other people are here.
Got it.
So let's go back just a little tiny bit, if you don't mind, because you see you're coming out with some words that are really quite interesting, and it's really something that those that are listening on their computer who don't know that much about child abuse and so forth. A lot of times, you know, children do in the grooming process. Children do many times feel special. They feel different. They feel like, they're loved and all this other stuff by the man or the woman, right? It can be a woman, too, who grooms them. And so I can understand what you're saying, that when you were leaving, when you saw him, he walked by you and just said, oh, hello, Janet, and your heart dropped. Because this is a man that you had very mixed feelings for. It's written here in the bio that you felt scared at times. You felt less than. You felt special though, and it was just like flip flop of feelings.
Right.
And I just want people to know that that's very, very common, and it does happen because many times the person who grooms you. With me, it was always very volatile. There was never any grooming. But if you are in a situation where you are groomed, you can go through all of this, all the flip-flops of emotional feeling that you go through. And I think that's very difficult on a child, too. With me, there was no question, okay? It's volatile. There was hate, okay? With you, you had sort of like you just said, you had feelings of remorse because he didn't give you that special wink or look at you in such a way because you thought you had more than that. So that's another part of what happens in child abuse. I just wanted to get that out because sometimes, you know, kids feel very, ashamed or whatever because maybe they had feelings for their abuser. But this, in the grooming process, they can make you feel loved and special, which is what it says here in the bio. You felt loved and special. Yeah. Okay, go on from there. I just wanted to get that out. And I'm going to go to the panel.
Yeah.
Let me go to the panel. Is that okay?
Okay.
I'm going to do
that.
Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's start up at the top with Pamela and see if she does have some questions. Go ahead, or comments to make. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, Janet. When you were at that Rotary Club meeting and the woman was talking about child abuse and you realized you were the only one, you didn't have any feelings of trying to find out if there was any way for you to get help or talk to your mother or, you know, here you are by yourself thinking this thought. How did you handle it just within yourself? What did you think you should do next?
Well, so I still didn't feel comfortable talking to my parents. I just wasn't ready to do that. But I did. I have a very supportive husband, and he's been just my rock, and he's the one that's helped me through a lot of stuff, and so he helped me go through that. I didn't go through counseling. There were a lot of other issues that were going on in my life at that time, so that was not the most important one, and so I think that's why. I mean, you know, you have to, I don't know about everybody else, but I know I'm this way. I compartmentalize things. And so I can put something aside and compartmentalize it and not think about it because I've got other things going on. And I had young children at the time, two very young children. And so I had to take care of them, and I had to make sure my priorities were straight with them. I also was living right next door to my mother-in-law, who, that was another interesting story. You don't even want me to go there.
So there
were a lot of things going on in my life during that time.
Yeah. Well, I identify with you on that I didn't even start dealing with it because I thought I would never have to, really, because I was so busy, like I said, with my career, my husband, my family, and everything. But in my 50s, with my empty nest, and I was all alone, and my husband was at work, you know, and I had to deal with it. That's when it came up, and I had to deal with it. So, you know, you can deny for a long time, but it has to be dealt with at some point.
Right. I agree completely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Carol, thank you.
No, you're welcome. Let me go down, let's go down to Doug. Maybe now he has a question or a comment he'd like to make, or maybe just wants to listen. Okay, hold on. There you go. Your mic is open.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I really can't think of anything. I just know that, I guess my only comment is that it seems like mostly within the last 20, 30 years, maybe with the information age, and that more survivors are able to come out and share their stories and find people who believe them. Because I know that it just seems that, you know, this problem has been so widespread for so long that it really wasn't, I guess, I don't know. It's a shame that so many things get swept under the rug. And, you know, when you're a kid, it's like there's not much you can do about it. You know, I try to speak up in my own way, and things got internalized, and so I guess all I could say is thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that's good, Doug. That's okay. Well, that's the way it is most of the time. You know, things do get swept under the rug. It takes many times people don't tell their story until they're 50, 60 years old.
Right.
And, that can happen. Well, then there are those that have a big mouth like I do, and I kept trying to tell all the time, and people just didn't care, okay? Now, that happens, too. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone has their own time as to when they're going to tell. Okay, thank you for that, Doug. Let's go down to Bill is listening. I don't know. I'm going to just open up his mic quickly, though, and see if there is something he'd like to say.
Yeah, that's good. I'm working. I work on Fridays in the background, but I also trail for you. So sometimes I'm in the middle of doing something. I put that. But anyway, you're doing a great job, Janet, with tonight's show. Doug, I'm wondering how how long it's been since you've been aware of this, or how you found NASCA. That was that would have been an interest to me if his mic had still been open, because I think it's his first time being here from Maryland. And I identified with a lot of what Janet said. I was groomed. My special gift, you know, from the person that groomed me was photography. And really good photography. I mean, like, he had his own dark rooms and cameras and all that. And I was craving some way of expressing my creativity. And he, at 11 years old, he started giving me these big cameras and lenses. And for the next 3 years, he groomed me. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, when I finally did tell, I told the person that I thought would be my savior, a person that would be my savior, because having been raised Catholic, you know, you guys talked about how in our era, you were supposed to admire adults and so forth. Of course, we don't do that anymore. We don't. That's not the message we give to kids. But back then it was, and especially that was true when you had a priest in the parish, you know, or a priest in the family, or you know, priests were supposed to be extremely well respected and helpful in, no matter what the situation was, and that's who I chose to tell. A priest, and told him my whole story, which took, like Janet said, a couple of hours, at least, and he turned out to be a predator too. So it just destroyed me. I tried to tell him when I was 14 or 15 years old, and it took me all the way till I was 30 years old to find an appropriate place to tell my story. Even though, like Carol, I tried to tell and I tried to tell and I tried to tell, and I was admonished and turned away at every step. Until I was 30 years old. So this is really, really common. And actually, 30 years old, I was lucky. That was early. And it's still early today. The average person is, you know, can get help maybe in their 40s nowadays. That's what we find. But the point is that if the first person you tell is not helpful, keep telling. And this is also true for children. It's the last thing we should explain to children after all the dangers are explained. Then we tell them to tell an adult. We should also tell them, but if the first adult doesn't help you, tell another one. If that one doesn't help you, tell another. In other words, keep telling until you're believed and helped. So thank you, Janet, for giving us these couple of little nuggets. I really appreciate it. And you're doing a great job.
Sure.
And thank you, Carol,
thank
for
you
a great
so much.
Job.
No,
okay.
Thank you
so much.
No. Thank you. Thank you for that, Bill. Okay, let's go down to Darlene and see if she wants to just listen right now or if she wants to speak. Go ahead.
Hey there. I just kind of laughed when you said that you had moved to Columbia, Tennessee. And
yes,
I have moved from Alabama to Pulaski, which is 30 minutes drive from Columbia.
Yep.
And, you know, so I'm like, okay, I know where she's talking about.
Yeah. Awesome.
So I'm like, all right, already then. And you are not to blame, you know, you still could not trust your parents because just the way they were thinking. So there was no way in you telling them when you would feel like you would get any support whatsoever.
Exactly.
Any protection, you know. So I can understand you not telling. And I did the same thing. I couldn't tell nobody till some of it I uncovered that I found out that I was really sexually sold, you know, pornographically and, you know, put out there. I'm one of them kids that's been, you know, cut between legs and all that, you know. So I know what you're going through, girl, and I'm here for you if you ever need to talk.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, darling. Yeah. Okay. And let's go down to William. Okay.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering, though, with being around the Japan area and the Philippines, did she run into the triad and things with the human trafficking?
That's an interesting story. I have something to tell you about that.
Yeah, because that's what I was wondering because of where you were located.
Do you want me to tell you a story about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so before I go, I just want to say do a shout-out to my sister, Gaylin, if she's listening on this meeting. She was going to try to come in on. She was also sexually abused by Jack Moyer, and she said she was going to try to tap in tonight. Anyway, Gaylin, if you're out there, I love you. So my seventh grade year, one of the things that we did that summer was we went and had a meeting. Well, I say a meeting. We had a what would you call this? I'm having trouble trying to figure out what the words are. But so we were on the beach, and we had a roast. We took
mussels from the ocean, and we had a mussel roast, and we cooked the mussels on the beach, and we had this big feast. And there were many Japanese businessmen there. There were several of us young female girls there. And one of my friends got a bottle of Suntory whiskey. And we started drinking. I was in seventh grade, 11 years old, or 12 years old at this point. I started drinking this Suntory whiskey. And we got drunk. I mean, we got so drunk. And that also is when I started smoking. I started smoking, and I started drinking at 12. And we drank that Suntory whiskey until we were sick. That saved us from, in my opinion, from the sex trafficking, because I think he had us set up to be sex trafficked that night. And all of us got blown away drunk. I mean, we were throwing up all over the place. We were just drunk. And he was angry because we embarrassed him. But I think more importantly, he was angry because he wasn't able to do anything with us. So I think that was kind of an interesting sex trafficking experience that I think we had. Didn't know it at the time. But again, I think that we were protected by the alcohol, which is kind of an interesting way of doing things in terms of God protecting us. And there's a lot of trafficking out of Philippines, but we, fortunately, none of us were in harm's way that night because of that Suntory whiskey. So, I mean, here we are, 12 years old, drinking alcohol, but like that kind of potent, you know, whiskey. I mean, I will never put that in my mouth again. It was, I still remember how bad I felt. And, you know, I think that I do think, I mean, can you imagine being on a beach in the middle of the Japan Sea with a roast where you're roasting mussels, where you're sitting around tables with a bunch of Japanese businessmen, and you're 11 or 12 years old female American person?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just kind of bizarre.
They didn't have good intentions. Janet, they did not have good intentions.
They did not at all. Uh-uh.
And I think what happened was you got so drunk they didn't want to mess with you. They didn't want to deal with you, you know. So
right. I mean, because we were throwing up. I mean, you know, we were so sick. It was just, and he was so angry with us. He was so his temperament was this. He was very, very sweet, but then he would get very, very, so he had a lot of anger issues. And later on I found out that he had a lot of issues with his mother. And so I don't know what transpired there, but evidently there was some things that one of my friends, Roger Wigan, went and did some kind of deep dive investigation into his life and called me and told me about his history. And evidently one of the issues that he had was mother issues. So he started actually abusing girls when he was like 16 or 17. And it continued after that. So
that happens a lot.
But yeah, that was a good question. That was a really good question. Yep.
Yes, it was. Yeah, and I'm you know, I don't usually say this, especially on air, but I'm glad you were drunk. I think you have something there because they didn't want to deal with you know, your friends and you with vomiting all over the place. So look at someone else.
Exactly.
You see, that's what they do. That's what they
do. Exactly.
They go then to someone else. They find a new prey, P-R-E-Y.
Right.
You know, where they're not vomiting all over the place and so forth. That was interesting.
Right.
Let me thank you for that, Bill, for bringing that up. William, I'm sorry. Yeah, William. Let me do the 563 area code. Let me open up your mic.
Hi, Carol.
Hear me.
Hi, Carol. This is Joe Potosi.
Hey.
Joe Potosi. Hi, Bill. I tuned in late. Hang on.
I don't know how much you've been listening to. I just saw your number now just pop up. maybe just want to listen then, because you did tune in late. But
yeah, so,
this gal here, yeah, she's very, 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 very interesting. She has a lot of twists and turns in her story, so you have to sort of like concentrate. But anyway, I'm glad you called
me. Let me say, Carol, welcome to Joe. He hasn't been around for a while, and so I just want to acknowledge that I'm here, too. He was trying to say hello to me, and I appreciate it. Thank you for coming back. I hope you come back again, Joe.
I will be. Don't worry. I miss you guys.
Okay.
And thank you, ma'am, for sharing your story. And I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, we're glad you're here. We're glad you're here. And you come back soon, okay?
Okay.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to the story. Okay. So you turned off a whole bunch of Japanese guys that were going to do terrible things with you. And I'm glad that you did that. I'm so glad that that happened and thankful.
Yeah.
I think God was watching over you. Okay. So go from that point on. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one story that I do remember is we were driving around the island, and one of the things that Jack would let us do is he would let us sit in his lap and drive the car. And so, of course, that gave him an opportunity to feel you up or whatever it was that he was doing. But it was a cool thing. We wanted to drive. So, of course, we would drive and sit in his lap, and then he would perform his, you know, sick minded things that he would do. And so I remember one particular night we were driving around the island, and I was sitting in his lap, and, you know, he was having his way with me or whatever. And there was a cat that was at a house. And I just remember this cat for some reason. I don't know why that's significant. I don't think that is significant. I just remember this cat being at this house. And then another thing, I'm very gullible. I've learned in my years now to not be so gullible, but I am very gullible. And so we were driving around the island, and the reflective light would come up, you know, where the car would shine on those reflective lights. And he told me, he said, did you know that there are little old ladies that live underneath the road, and they turn those lights on every time the car comes around? And I believed him. I thought that was true. And so I'm thinking there are these little old ladies, little old Japanese ladies living under the road, and they're turning the reflective lights on every time a car passes. And so that was just kind of an interesting story about how gullible and how vulnerable I was as a child.
Right.
One more story that's kind of an interesting thing is that he developed a system where, okay, his house was very near a Japanese shrine. And so the shrine was probably about half of a mile from his home. And every time we would go to the island on Friday night, he would tell the shrine story. And the shrine story was a story about an old woman who ended up dying in the woods of the shrine. And she lived there, and she would haunt the people that would come to the shrine. And we had to, in order for us to have a rite of passage, we had to go up to the shrine and either retrieve a wooden spoon that he had placed on the shrine step or place the wooden spoon on the shrine step. And so it was a challenge to anybody who wanted to go to the into the woods where this old woman haunted. And so I finally did it one night when the full moon was out and I could see, and it was not dark. And I sang the song by Sly and the Family Stone, "You Can Make It If You Try." And so I sang that song all the way up to the shrine steps, got the spoon, and brought it all the way back. And I was successful in my endeavor. Most people either make it or don't. I mean, it's an interesting thing that we did as kids. It was kind of like the challenge of the seventh grade kids. If you went on this trip, you were challenged to go to the shrine to get the spoon. So that's just another kind of intriguing part of the storyline. And so
what's kind of fun is when we were living in Nashville, my husband and I were living in Nashville, and our kids were in the Cub Scouts. I was the Cub Master, and I decided to do the same thing to the Cub Scouts one night when we were camping up in Kentucky. And I told the story about the old woman in the woods, and I did this whole same thing with the kids. And all the parents the next morning were just yelling at me, and they were not happy because none of their kids slept all night long because they were so scared about this old woman in the woods. It was kind of funny. Anyway, I may have a little bit of a, vindictive nature or whatever you want to call it. But anyway, that was kind of a fun thing that came out of that. So you can use some of your experiences to the positive, right? I think that you can take some of the things that have happened to you and turn them into something that is good. And so that was one of those things that I think I turned into good. But anyway, back to the volcano. So in the year 2000, the volcano erupted in Miyake, and I got this email in my inbox from this woman, Jessica, asking me to donate to Jack Moyer. And I wrote her back, and I told her my story. And I told her, I said, I'm highly offended that you're going to be raising money for this man who sexually abused me. You need to know what my story is. And she wrote me back, and she said, I'm sorry that happened to you, but I'm going to keep on raising money for him. And so I said, okay, I'm going to get in touch with the school. So I contacted the school. At the time, the headmaster, I sent him a certified letter and also an email to make sure that he knew what was going on. I briefly told my story there. I just said, Jack Moyer abused me. I want to order that you all get Jessica to stop asking for money for him from alumnus because he sexually abused me. Again, I still didn't know I was the only one. I was not the only one. Still, this is the year 2000, okay? So by this time, I have 4 children. We are living in Tuscaloosa still, and I'm trying to respond to this email. So I informed the school. I send a certified letter. The headmaster at the time wrote me back and said, I will respond, and I didn't hear from him for 6 months. So 6 months later, I send another letter saying, have you done anything about this? And he said, our board is taking it under advisement, and we will get back to you. Nothing.
But that's so often is the case. Yeah, go ahead. I hope something comes from this. And then I want to get into your blog, and I also want to get into what you're doing today because the time is going by. But, six months went by, you didn't hear anything, and then finally you did hear it was under review. And what happened after that? Go ahead.
Okay, so in 2003, my husband and I were going to San Francisco for a 100-year anniversary for the school. We had a reunion in San Francisco. And prior to the reunion, we get an email from Mrs. Downs, who was the headmaster's wife, who wanted to write this 100-year anniversary book about American school in Japan. And so she's asking everybody to send in stories about their memories and their recollections of the school. And so I wrote her and I said, Mrs. Downs, I have no problem with you doing this 100-year anniversary. The only problem I have is if you put a chapter in there about Jack Moyer and laud his efforts because he's a sexual predator and he does not need to be recognized. Mm-hmm. So I hear nothing from her. We get to the reunion. My sister and I went, and my sister and my brother-in-law and my husband and I went to the reunion. And it's in San Francisco. There are 1,000 people there. I mean, it was an incredible turnout. We go into the lobby where the reunion is being, like the registration is, and the books that she published were sitting in the lobby. And I get the book, and I open it up to see if there's anything in there. And sure enough, there's a whole chapter of him in the book. And I hit the ceiling. I started laughing, actually. I started hysterically laughing. Well, about that time, my brother-in-law came and said to me, Janet, you need to come meet this person. Now, keep in mind, in 1990, when I had the reunion that I had in Long Beach, California, my friend Michelle, the girl that had rescued me, remember I told y'all she was the one that came and got me and pulled me over when she saw that he was abusing me and she brought me out. She was the one that saved me from getting more physically abused. My friend Michelle in 1990 was hooked on drugs. She was a hot alcoholic drug addict. She was at the reunion in 1990. She was so high that she couldn't even remember who I was. But I knew who she was. And so I told my sister in 1990, I said, that's Michelle Connor. She's the girl that saved my life. But Michelle didn't remember because at this point she couldn't even function. I mean, she was doing drugs. She was just stoned out of her mind at the reunion. And so so fast track to 2003, when we were in San Francisco, Michelle was there and she was sober. And she was on a mission. She was on a mission to find out what happened. So my brother-in-law was in the photo booth with the class of 1973 or whatever, and Michelle was there and said, I'm on a mission. I'm going to find out what happened with Jack Moyer because I saw a lot of stuff. And so he immediately grabbed Michelle, and he came over and grabbed me and said, you guys need to meet. And so we got together, and she said, Janet, and I said, Michelle, you saved my life. And she was just, I mean, we just broke down sobbing because it was a reunion for us that we didn't even expect to happen. At this point, I was ready to put everything to rest. And so Michelle was on a mission. She was on a mission to find out what was happening with Jack Moyer. And so she and I went off. This was in the summer of 2003. And then so we started working with the school. We started working with Jack. He was still alive. He was still working with Japanese girls. Whether or not he was still sexually abusing them at this point, I don't know. He was 75 years old. I don't know. And she was going to take him down. She was going to take him down. And so we worked from 2003 to 2004. And on January the 9th of 2004, I got a call from a friend of mine that said that he had committed suicide. Then the horrific stuff started happening after that because his wife called me from the Philippines begging for money. I had no money to give her. He left her penniless. She had two children, trying to raise two children. And she's still very young because he was, 70. She was 18 when they got married. Two young children. That's what happened in 2004. And my mother, I went to tell my parents. Well, so when I was 36, I told my parents. And, of course, I got the reaction I expected. Basically, my dad said, you just need to forgive. And my mom was kind of speechless. She didn't know what to say. So my parents weren't really supportive of me. They protected their reputation more than anything else. And so I was able to tell my parents because my siblings were with me, and they were able to help me and protect me from my parents, which, and by the way, I've ended up with a wonderful relationship with my parents. So we were able to reconcile, and we were able to get through all of that stuff, but it took years and years. there's so much more to this story that I can't. I'm not even scratching the surface. So I know we're running out of time. We've got 15 more minutes.
Yeah, we are.
So
we're running.
I don't know what. Yeah.
Okay, let me help you with this. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. You've told us a wonderful story here, and it's very, very interesting. And you know, as far as with your parents, that's always up to the individual. Some people do forgive, other people don't forgive, and whatever is good for them is what's good for them. Okay, I don't choose to forgive any of the ones that abused me because they knew what they were doing. So, you know, that's the way I look at it. So I gave it to God because it was too much for me to handle. Okay, that's the way I
explain
it. All right, and that's good enough for me. It says here that you suffer today from high blood pressure. I do want to get into this just a second more, because one thing that people have to understand is that when children are sexually abused, and then, of course, there's no help, all right, with so many children who do tell, a lot of times there's no help, and then there are many children who don't tell, and they go to their grave with it, for God's sake. It does affect you physically, you know, every way, physical, mental, emotional, in relationships, everything in your life. It says here that you had gone to a therapist for quite some time, and do you feel that therapist was able to help you, and did she understand, or he understand, sexual abuse and what you had gone through?
So I went through a lot of different kinds of therapists. We went through marriage counseling. I went through individual counseling. The last therapist I visited was after I visited Japan in 2016, mm-hmm. when we finally got some reconciliation. And I called him and I said, I need 2 hours. And he goes, I don't normally do two-hour sessions. And I said, I need 2 hours. Give me 2 hours. And he goes, well, I don't normally do 2 hours. And I said, I need 2 hours. That's all I need. And so after I told him what happened, and I gave him my story, and I told him everything. After it was all finished and I was able to get it all out, he said, yep, you needed 2 hours, and that's all. So I was able to satisfy what my needs were with that two-hour session of therapy.
High
blood pressure. A lot of my blood pressure issues are hereditary, so it's not all because of what the abuse was, but I think that it contributes to it. There's no doubt about it.
You do get triggered at times. There are times that you go backwards and you remember, and you know, you do have your fear, your anger. I mean, because that's what's written here in the bio. You have fear at times and anger, and you have all different other types of feelings. Not everyone is the same, okay? And but one thing we do have in common is, you know, once you realize that it was never, ever, ever your fault, okay, you do get on your healing journey, hopefully, and you can live a good, and you can live a good productive life. You absolutely can.
Right.
And so let's go into what you're doing today. Okay. I know that you're writing a blog, it says here, and doing the work of writing a blog. Tell us about your blog, and then we'll get back to the CEO, which you are, of Hope Ministries. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So in 2004, after my mom died, well, let's see, not 2004. Hang on a second. Let me fast forward. So in 2000, oh, my gosh, I'm trying to remember all the dates. But anyway, it was when the movie Julie and Julia came out. It was a movie about Julia Child and a young woman, Julie, decided to follow Julia Child for 365 days a year. And she cooked all of the different recipes in Julia Child's cookbook, and she wrote a blog about it. And so when I saw that movie with my daughter, I was like, oh, I need to write a blog. That's what I need to do. That's how I need to tell my story, because up until this point I was thinking, I need to write a book, I need to get this published or whatever, and I still think it would be a fascinating movie. So I started writing a blog, and I started writing and writing and writing and writing and writing, and I wrote for about 3 years, and then I was done. I was ready to put it up. That's all I needed. I was ready to hang my hat and say, I'm mm-hmm. finished. And then in mm-hmm. 2016, a young mm-hmm. woman named Jennifer Bogle was at her therapist because she had been sexually abused by Jack Moyer. And her mm-hmm. therapist said, do you know anything about his life? Do you know if he's still living? Do you know anything? And she said, no. And she said, well, you need to find out. And so she started researching, and she found my blog. And she immediately called me and said, I need your help. And I said, I'm done. I'm done. I don't want to do anything else. She said, well, I was sexually abused by Jack Moyer, too. And I said, well, then, Jennifer, you're going to have to do your own work because I can't do any more. I'm finished. I am done. Mm-hmm. And Michelle was feeling the same way. Both of us had felt like we had done the work. We didn't need to do any more. We were finished. Well, Jennifer Bogle didn't feel that way. She felt like she needed to do some research. And so she started doing more research. And that's when we hired the attorneys in Portland, because we identified probably at least 35 girls who had been sexually abused by this man over the course from 1968 to 1990. And he was at the same school for that entire time, which is very rare. This is a rare case. Most predators move from place to place. This man was in one place, one school, all the children in one school. And so
that's because he never really got into trouble, isn't it? Go ahead.
Yep. So he was very, very, I don't know what else to say about that. But anyway, so back to my blog. So my blog created this for Jennifer. She was able to look into the information, and then subsequently we hired these attorneys, and they were able to get us a settlement from the school finally in the year 2016. And
that's
so we continued to hound the school. All we wanted was an apology. That's really all we wanted.
Right.
That's there were 13 of us. All we wanted was an apology. They could not give us an apology. And so we were like, okay, well, the hell with you. We're going to go for it. We're going to go for the money then. We're going to hit you where it hurts. And so we did. We hired these attorneys, and seriously, we had a call. Actually, the then board chair and the headmaster and the principal, they were all going to travel to the state and visit each one of. There's four of us they were going to visit in 2016, and they canceled their trip and said we're not coming. And then that's when we hired the attorneys. We were like, okay. You're not going to do what's right, then we're going to get attorneys. And so we hired the attorneys in Portland. They were fantastic. I cannot say more about them. And all the rest of the stories in the blog, so you can read it there. And then with regards to, I know we're running out of time, so I want to make sure.
Yeah.
With regards to my work, so I work for a nonprofit in Baton Rouge called Hope Ministries of Baton Rouge. We actually serve the entire Louisiana community, and we do workforce training, and we do retention services for companies that have a high population of people who have been raised in generational poverty. And so we help companies increase their retention, and we help people keep jobs. So it's a win-win for everybody. And we also get people jobs who are paid more than the minimum wage so they can have sustainable employment. So that's kind of what we do. I'm very proud of my work. We're growing like leaps and bounds, and it's very important work here in Louisiana. So thank you all so much for letting me share my story tonight. And if you want me to come back on, I'd be happy to.
Let me say something.
Information.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, what I want to say to you, because we are running out of time, what I want to say to you is you were a wonderful guest. You told us your whole story, and you're doing fine today. Now, with the adult survivors of child abuse, so often because of what they did go through as children, you know that it can absolutely stunt their lives, it can change their lives, and it takes an awful lot for them to get to a point in their life where they can meet their own potential, you know, of what they can be. And they have to learn so much and go to therapy and so forth. So this Hope Ministries sounds like something that I'd love to have and I'm sure Bill would too. I would love to have you know, more information on it. Maybe you could send something to Bill or to Pamela. Pamela's down at the bottom there with her bottom of the page. That's NASCA, NASCA.org, NASCA.org. And you can send information to her. So we have more information about Hope and you know, what you're doing, ministries. Now, we only have maybe about 2 or 3 minutes left. And all I can say to you is this. You've come a long ways. And the fact that you only had to, you know, go for therapy for a short period of time, it doesn't matter if you go a short period of time or a very long period of time. Everybody is different. Everybody is different. And you're doing just fine. You're doing fine. So you can come on Monday through Friday. You know, we have different shows, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays are for survivors like yourself, okay? On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we do have, you know, the survivor professionals who come on who can speak about, you know, what they go through as children, how they feel, and then how they can heal. Feel and heal, because I believe, and many of us believe, we all believe that there is life after abuse. And that, so your ministry is very important, okay? It's very important. It shows that you're helping people who, you know, have been so hurt in one way or another, physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, whatever, sexually, everything, neglected, and that you can become, you know, a person. Absolutely, we are people of worth, okay?
Yep.
So, anyway,
let me say one more thing. Let me say one more thing real quick. If anybody would like for me to come and speak, I'm more than glad to do that. So that's something that I actually enjoy doing. I don't shy away from a microphone or a stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's something
that's
that
good.
I think that I'm very comfortable with. So if anybody does want me to speak, I'll be more than happy to entertain some opportunities.
Well, we'll keep that in mind also. And in the meantime, keep up the good work, because you see, again, there's so many people who need to heal, okay, and need to be taught all different types of things. And you're the person to do it. You're able to do it, okay? You did a fine job. And I'm going to speak for the whole panel, because we don't have any more time. We're running out of time here. And I know that they're very happy that you came on. And they're going to want to look at your blog, and they're certainly going to want to know. Again, her name is Janet Simmons, all right? And she is the CEO of Hope Ministries. And can they go to your website and get information from that, Hope Ministries, or do you want them to go to to the blog? I wrote a little something earlier, just so, you know, I'll be interviewing you tonight, and I know we'll have a good show, and we did. And but please feel free to come on anytime, Monday through Friday, okay?
Sounds wonderful.
You can be a part
of
the panel. Yeah, you can be a part of the panel. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you so much.
So
I appreciate it.
Okay. Now, you have 1 minute left, I think. What would you tell people out there who have gone through all kinds of abuse? What would you say to them?
This is what I would say, that there is a God. And that God understands your suffering, and you need to bear your soul and your heartache to Him, and He will heal you.
Okay.
And that's what I would say.
Well, I believe that. There's a lot of people who believe that. You know, so I'm going to have to wrap up the show now. But you know what time to call in. So anytime you want to call in, Monday through Friday, feel free, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you so much for coming on the show. Good night. God bless. And everyone, take care.
Good night.
I'll
Good night, honey.
Love Talk Radio.